This recording is in answer to a request by the University of Wisconsin History Project at Madison, Wisconsin in the year 1985. My name is Mary M. Taylor Vinge. The interview format misspelled my last name. I would appreciate it very much if you would spell that last name correctly. My last name is Vinge. It is spelled V as in victory, I as in ice, N as in Norman, J as in John, E as in Edward. My address is 786 Carlita Circle, Rohnert Park, California, 94928. I attended the University of Wisconsin at Madison, Wisconsin, from the fall of 1931 to the summer of 1938. During the years 1931 to 1935, I earned two college degrees, a BA, and, through a special program of advanced independent work, I also earned an MA degree. From 1935 to 1938, I worked toward a PhD degree, which I received in 1938. As far as I am concerned, beginning college went back to before I went to high school. I graduated from Central High School in Madison, Wisconsin in June of 1931. But I had already decided that I wanted to attend college when I was in fifth grade. I made my decision at 3 o'clock one Friday afternoon. The fifth grade school teacher, Miss Grossmeyer, had told us that we were going to spend some time every Friday afternoon reading about something that interested us, and then we could tell the class about it. She suggested that I would like to read a little red book about a trapdoor spider. I was trapped, and of course I realized that if I wanted to understand such things, I ought to go to college. I loved to study and was fortunate enough to go to a high school at a time when school policy was, if a student has college potential, train him. Students who were considered to have college potential were put together in a special homeroom and in special classes, which were so demanding that when I went to college, it was no more than a logical succession to a previous year. However, I didn't realize until I reached college that my high school training had been quite unique. I am sure that it had such a great influence on my success in college that I would like to digress long enough to explain why I think that my high school experience was so important. On the first day of school, the opening sentence of the homeroom teacher, Miss Lita Wilson, was, "You are not going to like me very well, but 10 years from now, you will be very glad that I taught you how to concentrate." And teach us she did. The first time another teacher came into the room, every student in the room looked up, whereupon Miss Wilson explained in exquisite English that we were not in that room to gawk, but to study. And if we ever expected to be successful in college, we should start learning now. She was an expert at conjuring up distractions and then withering the miscreants with sarcasm if we failed to maintain concentration. As a freshman in high school, I was terrified of her. But one of the byproducts of her tutelage was that at home I could concentrate on doing my homework in spite of my younger sister's favorite radio program, Carlton Myers Kindergarten, to which she was listening only 3 feet away from my desk. There was no hush, hush, Mary is trying to study in our household. The other classes to which I was assigned had teachers who were equally demanding, and the students in my class were tough competition. Each of the demanding teachers taught us something special in addition to his particular subject. A history teacher, Mr. Dennison, not only taught us ancient history, but also how to scan a page in the book to find the pertinent information. As a study technique, it was invaluable. We also learned something about the difference between a well-written text and one which was not. Ever after, I resented poorly written textbooks. And I met a few at the university along with the author. The English teacher, Miss Powers, taught English so well that students from her class were able to test out a freshman English when they went to college. And the biology teacher, Mrs. Perkins, made biology so exciting that I knew that somehow I wanted the biological sciences to play a large part in my life. My high school teachers were so successful in their efforts that when I did go to college, there was little adjustment necessary. It was just passing on to the next grade level. The only college I ever thought about was the University of Wisconsin. I chose it because I had played on the campus as a child, because it had an enviable reputation, and because not only my parents encouraged me in the desire to have a higher education, but also the Central High School teachers encouraged me to think of college in terms of the University of Wisconsin. I did not have a specific goal in mind when I entered the UW, except that I knew I wanted to be in the biological field. I was not very interested in the idea of teaching. I dreamed of research. My only memory of orientation relates to taking entrance exams, one of which, English, excused me from having to take freshman English as such, and allowed me to take a special writing course, which has influenced my entire life. I was especially fortunate in having Dr. C. H. Sorum, Assistant Professor of Chemistry, as my advisor for the first 2 years. He helped me develop a well-rounded program and helped solve the inevitable conflicts that always seemed to arise between students and the registrar's office. My memory of registration envisions a large room, perhaps a gym, with long tables, boxes of cards, and the inevitable class schedules. On one side of the table were the people who passed out those class cards, and on the other side of the table stood the students, each one worried that the class would be closed before he could get that all-important class card, and getting very tired of standing in line. My major was botany, but when I went to the university, I intended to major in zoology. However, I decided to take 1 year of botany as a background, and then in my sophomore year, I took an introductory course in zoology. I still cannot understand how such a fascinating subject as zoology could have been reduced to utter boredom in a lecture, and how a text could have been so disorganized. I decided to major in botany. Enough said. But that is how botany became my major. I took at least one course, and often more, under each of the professors and assistant professors, except one, in the botany department. And I never encountered a teacher who was not very well versed in his field, though personalities varied. And within my experience, I never had a teacher who was not accessible during the day. They always had their office door open and were willing to give help. 10 years after graduation, I became a college professor for 32 years, and I know that my teaching techniques were borrowed from the mentors I encountered at the University of Wisconsin. I feel that I was exceptionally fortunate in having known so many inspiring teachers. I shall list them sequentially, the names of some of those who had the greatest influence on my life. Dr. George Bryan, the dynamic lecturer who captured my imagination when I was a freshman in introductory botany, and in advanced classes, he made a study of higher plants unforgettable. It was he who made botany so fascinating that I shifted my allegiance from zoology to botany. Dr. Emma Fisk, introductory botany was what she taught. She was demanding, but not unreasonable. Her lectures were not always exciting, but they were the epitome of organization. And in the second semester of introductory botany, she made the history of botany relevant. In the advanced courses, which I took from her, she showed me the relationship of the smallest part to the whole. One course, The Structure of Economic Plants, still rises to haunt me when I am eating vegetables and fruits whose interior structure is no mystery. Dr. Norman Fassett in taxonomy. He was a quiet man until he started to talk about plants. He could take a dried plant from the herbarium or an odds and ends bouquet from the forest and the field and make the fine art of classification as interesting as solving a mystery story. Dr. E. M. Gilbert, chairman of the botany department. His course on fungi introduced me to the field of mycology, which in turn led to its being my major field and ultimately to my major thesis, and an opportunity to do some very interesting research. Dr. Gilbert was a quiet man who became my advisor in my junior year. He encouraged me to do more than I thought I could and always seemed to have time for a discussion. Dr. Charles Allen, he introduced me to the study of cells, sharpened my powers of observation, and improved my ability to draw what I saw rather than what I thought I saw. He was the perfectionist who, it was said, graded our laboratory drawings with a hand lens to make sure that the dots were truly spherical. He led me through the rigors of learning to use an oil immersion lens and a microscope to the point where my observation was heightened to pure enjoyment. And he also taught me microtechnique, patiently but persistently, until I learned how to make microscope slides that were good, bad, and indifferent, but ultimately satisfactory and occasionally excellent. And the techniques I learned were to serve me well when many years later I found myself teaching microtechnique at the college level. Dr. Benjamin Duggar, the plant physiologist, a quiet man without much sense of humor as far as I could tell, very reserved. He was not a dynamic lecturer, but so intense and often erudite were his lectures that I am grateful for the knowledge I absorbed. He was famous in his field, but his subject was not one of my favorites. I must admit that I remember him best because each year he treated the seminar students and the faculty to a mushroom feast. He was a good cook as well as a good botanist. Within the department, as far as I know, there were no clubs or social affairs. The weekly seminars were semi-traumatic or semi-social in that if you were the speaker, it was traumatic. If you were not the speaker, it could be fascinating or boring, but I suspect it was very good training. The tea and cookies afterwards made a pleasant social affair. At the end of the school year, there was a departmental picnic, which I remember with pleasure. I cannot name my favorite class outside of the department because there was more than one. If I were to choose a sequence of courses to broaden a student's horizon, I would choose the following courses, providing they could be taught by the ghosts of the teachers I had. No others could compare. Last year, I read in one of the Wisconsin alumnus magazines that a special course in writing was going to be made available to a group of selected students chosen by the teacher in charge. I congratulate any student who has that privilege, and I hope that they will value and enjoy such a special course as much as I did. I hope that the university has not forgotten that back in 1931, Professor W. Taylor offered a special course in writing to some of the students who had tested out of having to take freshman English. I was one of the lucky ones. The course was unique. We learned to write by writing, but along with that, Professor Taylor read to us once a week a letter which he had received from some well-known author, which discussed techniques. It was a rather awe-inspiring experience for a first semester freshman. The writing assignments required us to try a variety of literary efforts: essay, poetry, letter, short story, long story, novelette, and so forth. Professor Taylor graded our efforts, but more important were the conferences, which gave us an opportunity for meaningful criticism and discussion. The most exciting course I took outside of my field was a course in anthropology by Professor Ralph Linton. He always made a dramatic entrance from the back of the lecture room, and in the winter he wore an enormous black fur coat and hat. From the back he looked like a large gorilla, and I'm sure that he knew it, but that was just a prelude to his very fascinating lectures, which opened new worlds to me. Probably the courses I enjoyed the most outside of my major field were the geology courses I took under Professor W. H. Twenhoffel, who didn't like having women in his class. At his first lecture in physical geology, he expected us to go on all the field trips, and if we couldn't keep up, that was just too bad. He proved his point by choosing the fields with the most fences and hillsides so steep that the most practical descent was to sit down and slide. He frowned at any male student who offered a helping hand. Historical geology was less threatening, and the lab portion, which was paleontology, was well taught by Dr. R.R. Schrock. The byproduct of the geology courses has been my increased enjoyment in traveling, especially since I very much enjoy our national parks, where understanding something about geology has increased my enjoyment tenfold. I wonder if the geology department still offers the course in gems and precious stones. That was a unique course, especially the field trip
to Nelson's Jewelry Store in downtown Madison, where we learned about color in diamonds, not by lecture, but by handling them. When I answered your first letter, I used the phrase project opportunity because I could only remember what a wonderful opportunity it had been for me to be able to secure the BA and MA degree within 8 semesters. After receiving your letter, I looked into my files and found that the correct title for the program was Advanced Independent Work. I first learned of the program by letter to me from the Graduate Committee of the Graduate School in September 4, 1933. The letter advised me that since I was one of the students who had secured a grade point average of 2.6 or higher on a scale of 3 for the 4 semesters ending June 1933, I was eligible to pursue advanced independent work, beginning with my junior year and leading to admission to the graduate school in my 8th semester. I would also be eligible for the new Wisconsin scholarship of $150 for the 8th semester. There were 12 scholarships awarded, and 5 of the 12 went to Madison, Wisconsin residents, which I think speaks very well for the Madison school system. Professor E.M. Gilbert was my advisor in the project. The work project was not considered to be a course with exams, papers, and grades. In my case, it involved an extension of the research that I was doing for my thesis. My thesis involved extensive laboratory work with 2 plant symbionts. Because of the opportunity to pursue advanced independent work, I was also able to do a very extensive literature search, not only in my thesis topic of the specific species, but also a survey of the field. Dr. Gilbert's involvement included discussion, suggestions, and encouragement. There was also an evaluation by a committee of 3 faculty members. In my estimation, the project was of tremendous value. I acquired both a BA and an MA degree in 4 years. I gained knowledge that no formal course could have supplied, and I became better acquainted with the department faculty. In the fall, following graduation, I became a graduate assistant in the botany department and went on to receive my PhD in 1938. Next on the format was a question about housing. I chose to live off campus because I could live at home. I could not have afforded to attend college otherwise. I lived in the uptown area, North Butler Street, off East Washington Avenue, 2 blocks from the Capitol Square. It was an area of large old homes, mostly converted into apartments or rooms for rent. We lived downstairs in a 10-room house. I shared a small bedroom with my sister, and I studied in the corner of the dining room. We were a family of 4. My parents gave me room, board, and encouragement, and the rest was up to me. I walked everywhere. I had no money for the 10-cent streetcar fare. Leisure time was in short supply. When I was a freshman, I occasionally dated a high school classmate. When I was a sophomore, I met a young man at the university who became a steady date. Any leisure time was spent fishing, hunting, target shooting, hiking, picnics, and now and then a movie. Dates were only on weekends. Nights were devoted to studying. As I look back, I am amazed at the patience of my friend Jim. He never complained about the phrase I probably used overmuch. I'm sorry, I can't go out, I have to study. I'm so glad that he stayed around and married me several years later. As concerns the Memorial Union, I suspect that I went there perhaps twice a month, usually to meet someone. As I remember it at the time, women were not allowed in the Rathskeller, or if you prefer, the Rathskeller was open to men only. It seemed to make a difference to some of the women students. It concerned me not at all. The only social event of the year that I recall was military ball. My date was an officer and a member of Scabbard and Blade. My attendance was for me in the category of a Cinderella. I remember it as a sort of fairy tale. I remember coming down, or was it up, the staircase to the ballroom. My mother had made my dress, and I remember every detail of that dress. For the first ball, it was blue taffeta. For the next year, it was pink silk. I remember the lights, the music, the dancing, and the arch of swords, or should it be sabers. Especially, I remember how handsome my escort Jim looked. I haven't thought about that event for a long time. I married Jim the year I got my PhD, and we had a wonderful marriage, except that he died 20 years ago. In answer to your question as to how my education was financed, the answer is with difficulty, but also much good luck and kind people. I don't know how much detail you want on the subject of finances, but my curiosity led me back to my records, which I will summarize by the school year, just because I found them interesting and thought you might also. Mostly it was dollar by dollar, a few at a time. My aunts and uncles knew that I wanted to go to the university, so everyone gave me money as gifts when I graduated from high school. The smallest gift was 50 cents, as generous a gift from that giver as was the largest gift, which was $15. The total amount I received was $64.50. My expenses for the first semester totaled $51.43. Christmas brought more gifts, and I managed to get through the second semester when my expenses were $43.73, and even through summer school with expenses of $38.10. But in the fall of 1932, I could not have gone back to school had I not been able to borrow $35 from the university to cover my fees. I had a part-time job through the University Employment Office that involved checking some kind of tests at the beginning of the school year. It paid, I think, about 40 cents an hour. I worked 2 days. Work was very difficult to find. Then a lady offered me a job at 25 cents an hour to make dinner, clean up the kitchen, and then tutor her son in Latin and her daughter in English. I would have had to take a streetcar because the distance was too far to walk, and my profit would have been 80 cents and no time to study. However, fortune smiled, and I got a job at the Presbyterian Church, counting the collection, running off church programs on a mimeograph machine, and miscellaneous chores at $2 for a half a day's work every Saturday. The $85.60 that I earned that school year, plus the loan I was able to get, got me through the first and second semester and a summer school of my sophomore year. If you are interested in schedule of rates paid for hourly work in 1932, I refer you to the information sheet given to all self-supporting students at the University of Wisconsin. I sent a copy of this to Mr. Teicher with the letter I sent October 10, 1984. In the school year 1933-34, I again borrowed money in order to pay school fees. This time the loans were government loans of $36.10 for the fall semester and $37 for the spring semester. Starting in March, I got an FERA job at the university. I cannot remember what the letters stood for, except that I am sure that it was federally funded, and it paid $10 a month, and was, I believe, some sort of clerical work. It helped me buy books and also take 2 correspondence courses at the university during the summer. In the fall of 1934, I was still on FERA with an increase to $15 per month. I worked during the Christmas holiday selling Christmas cards at Mosley's Bookstore downtown for 3 days at $2.50 for an 8-hour day. My feet still hurt when I remember what it was like. In the spring of 1935, my FERA job ended in February, but I began receiving monthly installments, which averaged $27.40 from the scholarship associated with the independent work program. I managed to save enough money so that by the end of the semester, I was able to pay back the loan of $35, which I had made from the university in the fall of 1932. The interest was $2.10. The 2 interest-free government loans from the Industrial Commission were repaid at a later date. Commencement came in the June of 1935, but because of an accident, I missed my own graduation. I spent my graduation day in the hospital. But it was still a great thrill for my parents, as well as for me, that I did receive both my BA with honors and my MA at the same time. At that moment, all my efforts suddenly seemed worthwhile. But my biggest surprise was the opportunity to work during the summer months at the Forest Products Laboratory in the Division of Forest Pathology, headed by Dr. C. Audrey Richards. Specifically, I worked for Dr. Caroline Rumbold, associate pathologist who was a specialist in blue stain fungi. That first summer while I was there, Dr. Rumbold was called to Wyoming to investigate a fungus problem on pine trees. She sent the diseased wood back to the lab to be cultured. On her return, she offered me the opportunity to work on the fungus as a research project for my PhD thesis. The research was extremely interesting and very successful. The fungus was a new species, and its life cycle was the topic of my doctoral thesis. I had the pleasure of working at the Forest Products Laboratory for two more summers while I was in graduate school. My work at the Forest Products Lab helped me to finance my 3 years in graduate school and included the thrill of being able to buy a used microscope for $35. In the fall of 1935, I became a graduate assistant in the botany department at the university. My salary was $750 for the school year, less a $100 waiver. To me, this sounded like a fortune, and I was able to start paying $25 a month to my parents for room and board. My graduate assistantship involved working as a lab technician, preparing materials for use in the class laboratories. This I did for the 3 years while I was working on my doctorate. During the third year, one-fourth of my time as assistant was spent helping to teach in a lab section and a quiz section. Much to my surprise, I found that I enjoyed teaching very much and gave me a feeling of confidence to discover that if a career in research was impossible, teaching was an attractive alternative. I had the best of both worlds. For 3 years, my summers were a joy and a delight at the Forest Products Lab, and during the school year, I was back in the academic world. Graduate school was an unalloyed joy, for which undergraduate classes had been but a practice session. Any major field requires a supporting and related courses in other departments. In my case, a natural proliferation led to my taking courses in plant pathology and bacteriology on the Ag campus while I was in graduate school. I was fortunate enough to have exceptional teachers in these related fields also. I had four favorite courses on the Ag campus. Two were in bacteriology and two in plant pathology. Dr. William Sarles had made the introductory course in bacteriology so interesting during the first semester of my senior year that it gave me an appetite for more. In graduate school, I took, among others, Dr. Elizabeth McCoy's course in determinative bacteriology. It was a very demanding course, but very worth the effort. Dr. A.J. Riker's course in methods in plant pathology was one of the most imaginative courses I ever had. I remember going to a grocery store to look for green beans that had spots, sweet potatoes that looked moldy, and any vegetable or fruit that looked not good enough to eat, and bringing them back to the lab to culture them and determine the cause of the problem. I felt as if I were playing agricultural detective. And Dr. Riker's stories of his experiences during the World War, when bacteriology had to be practiced in the field where there was no laboratory, and how the problems were solved, certainly made his course both interesting and challenging. Also, it made me realize how fortunate I was to have had Dr. McCoy's course in determinative. Pieces all fell into place. The other course in plant pathology that was really unique, and I suspect more of a privilege than we students realized at the time, was a course in forest pathology taught by Dr. C. A. Richards, the pathologist in charge of the Madison Division of Forest Pathology of the Bureau of Plant Industry, USDA. From Dr. Richards, we learned some very interesting techniques and had an opportunity to see the practical side in a working laboratory. I think that the greatest pleasure in graduate school was watching the various subjects fall into place in relation to one another, and in suddenly realizing that many of the things that I had learned, sometimes by rote, actually had a practical application. More and more, I enjoyed the sophisticated courses, and I think I could have enjoyed being a perennial student. To return to answering the questions used in the format, it is obvious that my life at the university was somewhat different than that of many college students. Many of the format questions were not a part of my life. However, I will try to give answers where possible. As concerns the role religion played in my life, I was not involved in any campus religious practice. Since I had been born and lived in Madison until I finished graduate school at the university, I continued to attend the Presbyterian Church in downtown Madison as long as I lived there, and it was the Presbyterian Church which had given me a job when I so desperately needed one in the school year 1932-33. Clubs and organizations for me were professional rather than social. Sigma Delta Epsilon was a professional organization for graduate women in science. I regret that I do not remember very much about it. There were meetings in the homes of some of the members, and I attended and enjoyed those meetings when I had the time to attend. It was not purely social. The programs were on scientific topics. As concerns honorary societies, I was elected to Phi Beta Kappa in my senior year, 1935. Except for the initiation banquet in April, there were no meetings during the year as far as I know. There were 50 students elected in 1935, 27 men and 23 women. I was most pleased to be one of them. I continue to enjoy their quarterly newsletter, The Key Reporter, and their quarterly magazine, The American Scholar. I was pleased to be elected in 1937 as a member of Sigma Xi, the Society for the Promotion of Research. I believe that there were meetings, but I was not able to attend. However, I found that belonging to Sigma Xi was very much an asset when I joined the teaching staff at St. Ambrose College in Davenport, Iowa. The city of Davenport is one of a group of four cities, hence the name Quad Cities. The Quad Cities is the center of farm equipment manufacturing industry such as John Deere, International Harvester, J.I. Case, Caterpillar. There were also industries such as Alcoa, Bendix, Eagle Signal, and the Rock Island Arsenal. And in addition, there are four colleges. As a result, there was much interest in the sciences and engineering in the Quad Cities. In 1967, John Deere Company sponsored the formation of a Sigma Xi chapter. I was one of the charter members and a very active member, even to serving a stint as president. Because of the academic mix in the Quad Cities, the programs were always very interesting and the meetings were well attended. In regard to publications, I could not afford the campus publications, though in my senior year I did subscribe to the Daily Cardinal so that I might have some news of what was going on campus. I do not remember having any reaction to it, except that one day they announced the names of those elected to Phi Beta Kappa. That day I remember. In regard to student attitudes, again I ask you to remember that I was a very academically minded student. I was working hard trying to earn enough money to stay in school and at the same time have enough to study as much as I wanted. I really loved to study and my social life was very low key because I was so busy. I guess I was not very conscious of student attitudes. However, I really do not remember any evidence of racial discrimination in any of my classes. I was aware of radical student groups because of what I sometimes read in the papers, but I do not even remember whether what I read was in the Wisconsin State Journal, the Capital Times, or the Cardinal. The only unusual incident that I personally knew about and consider really tragic was when a young, very brilliant student chose to leave school and go to Spain to fight in the Civil War that was going on there. He died there, and I think the world lost a potentially great physicist. Concerning personalities, the Dean of Women was Louise Troxell. I never met her. I never heard her name mentioned. Glenn Frank was president of the university then. I knew his name at that time, but had no opinions about him. State Street and Madison were a part of my life from birth. I was born in Madison and lived there until I married. When I was at the university, I seldom ate out. I couldn't afford it. I carried my lunch. I did not shop very often on State Street. In fact, I did not shop very often. But I always bought my books at Brown's Bookstore. It's still there. I loved it because it had such good used book sales. I once bought an entire set of the Encyclopedia Britannica for $1. Of course, however, it wasn't entire. The last volume was missing. But if absolutely necessary, I could always go to the library and look up the letters XYZ. I used the encyclopedia for years and then passed it on to a young newspaper reporter who finds it very helpful about facts that have long since been forgotten or been reduced to a short paragraph in modern editions. I still miss it, but when one moves from Iowa to California, you do not bring the encyclopedia along. Occasionally, I shopped at Wordle's, the leather goods store on State Street. My prize purchase was a leather briefcase, which I used up until the 1970s, when a former student gave me one as a gift. Probably the most famous beauty shop on State Street was the Cardinal Beauty Shop. It was started in 1924 by Leonard Eberhard. Only for a very special occasion did I ever go to a beauty shop because of the expense. However, there were four such occasions during the 7 years that I was at the college. The first time was in 1931 when I went to get my hair cut. My hair was so long I could sit on it, and I had discovered that caring for it took far too much time away from my studying. The next two times were for military ball in 1933 and 1934, and the fourth event was for my wedding in the summer of 1938. But there is an interesting sequel to this story. My sister still lives in Madison, and on occasion through the years, I would go back to visit her, and when I did, I had my hair done at the Cardinal Beauty Shop, but not by Leonard, rather by Herb, his son, who had taken over the Cardinal Beauty Shop in 1943. And now the son has just retired, so that in 1985, although the Cardinal Beauty Shop may still be there, the Eberharts are not. Time marches on. In answer to your question, how did university students get along with local Madison youth? I was a local youth, and I didn't know there ever was a problem. Perhaps I was just too busy to recognize one. In regard to the Great Depression, Charles Dickens said it best in 1859, in the first line of Chapter 1 in Tale of Two Cities, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." I remember, especially for me, that clothes were way down on my list of priorities, and they still are. I don't remember that I worried very much that I couldn't afford to have any luxuries. I was just extremely grateful that I could buy used books. I worried when the man who held the mortgage on my folks' home threatened to foreclose. And I remember how grateful I was and how relieved and happy our whole family was when my fiancé went to a government agency, which investigated the situation, and awarded the home to my father free and clear because the man who held the mortgage had been dishonest and been taking advantage of my father. I don't remember feeling very deprived, except once when Thanksgiving dinner was one can of tomato soup for the four of us. Education was for many at that time a hard-won privilege, and my classmates in the botany department appreciated its value and worked long hours to acquire it. I think the people who had a goal were too busy to feel sorry for themselves. It was a challenge that helped me realize how unimportant material things were. I don't remember that the Depression was necessarily a topic of conversation. People learned that there were many things they could do without. And I don't remember any of my friends sitting around feeling sorry for themselves. Looking back, I suspect that the impact on the university was a budget problem, which meant that some programs had to be abandoned. But for all that, I think that within limits, of course, it's not so much the equipment that makes a university great as it is the faculty. And the faculty of the botany department at the University of Wisconsin helped me develop a good sense of values by being a good example. I like the word reflections. It gives me a chance to think back once more about the university days and what followed. I feel that I did achieve my career goal, though in a rather roundabout way. My career goal when I graduated from the university was to do research, or if not that, to teach in a college where I could do some research of my own and perhaps interest students in the idea. After receiving my PhD in 1938, I was hoping that I might continue in research, perhaps even at the Forest Products Lab, where I had just finished three wonderful summers of work. However, I got married in the June of 1938. My husband was transferred out of town, and I soon discovered that there weren't many opportunities for women in research. One of the cities we lived in was Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And my university education began to be put to use immediately. For 3 years, my husband and I were volunteers for the local museum. He was preparing exhibits, and I was identifying and cataloging an insect collection. Thus, the first year I was married, I was back in an academic atmosphere, and I never strayed very far. We eventually moved to Davenport, Iowa, in about 1945. It was during World War II, and my friends urged me to do some substitute teaching because there was such a teacher shortage. As a substitute teacher in the high school, I found that I enjoyed teaching more than I thought I would. However, my stint at the high school was short-lived because the state board frowned upon any teacher who hadn't had education courses. In their eyes, three college degrees were irrelevant. A local men's college by the name of St. Ambrose College heard about me and asked me to teach there. Ironically, they wanted me to teach anatomy and physiology to nurses. When I said that that wasn't my field, it was suggested that if I were smart enough to earn a PhD at the University of Wisconsin, I ought to be able to tutor myself through an introductory course in anatomy and physiology. I agreed to try it for a year, and for 15 years, I taught student nurses anatomy and physiology, and that was a real challenge. I also taught student nurses microbiology, which was no problem at all, since I had taken bacteriology in college, and mycology was my field. After 15 years, the nursing program was phased out, and I taught botany and biology to men. Eventually, the college became co-ed, enrollment increased, and I was teaching several courses in botany, one in entomology and one in environmental studies. Some of my students became interested in research and went on to graduate school. I managed to do some personal research, and during the summer, I solved a problem for the engineering company for whom my husband worked. The research that I enjoyed the most was aerobiological research done by my husband and myself as a team. We were both airplane pilots and made collections directly onto microscope slides of whatever microbiota we could trap at different altitudes. By use of weather maps, we were able to determine the probable origin of the microbiota. Our paper attracted the attention of the botany department at the University of Iowa and brought an offer of a grant to continue research. But I really enjoyed teaching, and some of my students were getting involved in research. My husband enjoyed his work, and our research was not subject to bureaucracy, so we remained where we were. During the resurgence of interest in science in the high schools in the early 60s, I was one of the visiting scientists in Iowa. In the 70s, I became chairman of the biology department at the college, but after 3 years, I asked to be relieved of that responsibility. My reason? When my students came to me asking for help, and I had to say, I'm sorry, I'm too busy, I have to get the budget in, or I have to go to a meeting, or I must finish a report, or I have to write up a request for a grant, it was time to get back to teaching. As I have been doing this tape, memories keep surfacing, and example after example comes to mind of what an unbelievable influence the university experience had on my life. When I was talking about classes outside of my major, I kept having the feeling that I was forgetting someone. How could I have not mentioned Dr. L. E. Noland? His course in entomology, which I took during the last summer of graduate school, was an unqualified success. In fact, I have sometimes thought that had I taken that course earlier as an undergraduate, I might have become a zoologist after all. I never lost interest in the insects, and eventually I taught a course in entomology at the St. Ambrose College for several years. In fact, entomology even became a part of my retirement. After I retired in 1979, I occupied the honorary Halberd Chair of Biology at St. Ambrose College for a year. And during that time, I had the pleasure of organizing an insect collection, which had been started in 1913, the year I was born. The collection had been well cared for and added to through the years, but never put in order. One of my first students at the college had become an MD, and he donated two Lane cases for protective storage. I spent the year completing the identification and cataloging of the 3,000 insects in the collection. However, my major field of botany was not neglected. The biology department also had a small herbarium of 4,000 plants, which dated back to 1871. Unfortunately, there was no catalog, though labels were quite complete. After organizing the insect collection, I remained at the college for another year, and with the help of another retired teacher, the plants were cataloged and crossed and a cross-index system was devised, which made the collection much more useful for teaching purposes. Hopefully, one of my successors at the college may recognize the tantalizing possibilities for a comparative study between the species of the plants collected in the past and those species present today in the same location. Of course, the same comparison would be possible with the insects. My work on the plant and insect collection was a wonderful finale to 32 years of teaching. One of the pleasures was having the sons and daughters of my former students show up in my classes toward the end of my career. I think it illustrates how far-reaching, even under the second and third generation, is the influence of the exceptional teachers I had at the University of Wisconsin. In 1980, I received an honorary degree from St. Ambrose College. I would like to add one more reflection. It's a small world. When I was about to retire, I was very pleased that the young man selected to replace me was Dr. Roland Duty, who had a PhD in botany from the University of Wisconsin. Our college had just acquired an electron microscope, and Dr. Duty had had considerable experience in electron microscopy. Good students were attracted to him, and he soon had some of the better students involved in research. I felt that the college was very fortunate to have him on the staff, and I enjoyed working with him for 2 years. Subsequently, Dr. Duty was offered a position at Auburn University in Alabama, and I'm very glad that he is able to continue his research at a university. The interview is continued on the other side of the tape. I welcome the opportunity to add some comments and a couple of anecdotes. I feel that the quality and scope of the education I received at the university were superb. I feel that I have used in one way or another every course in my major and related fields that was part of my academic program, and that the experiences that I had at the University of Wisconsin made me aware of infinite possibilities which I would not have recognized without having had the university experience. My educational experiences prepared me for survival and gave me self-confidence. I found that the principles and mental discipline and research techniques were applicable to a broad spectrum of challenges. I'm very glad that I learned how to adapt and to improvise. I wonder what would happen in today's computer world if fate should suddenly turn off the electricity. I am sure that on today's campus there are great teachers, though I find it hard to believe that there are very many who can measure up to the teachers I had 50 years ago, whose names I recall without difficulty, and the memory of the individual courses is recalled with pleasure. I would like to leave you with a couple of little stories. One of the incidents concerns the dignified Dr. Albert J. Riker, professor of plant pathology at the university. In my discussion of my experiences in graduate school, I have mentioned how much I enjoyed his class in methods in plant pathology and appreciated his sense of humor. His class was both interesting and challenging, but I remember him best as a member of the committee for my doctoral orals. How can I possibly forget that instead of having the orals in some professor's office, I was invited to lunch at the University Club on State Street? I cannot tell you what we had for lunch, but I can remember well the butterflies in my stomach. Most unforgettable was the climax. After the orals were over, I went out into the hall to await the decision. Dr. Riker came out first, stood straight and tall, and recited, "Happy little moron. He doesn't give a damn. I'm glad I'm not a moron. My God, perhaps I am." Whereupon he made a very formal bow, extended his hand, and said, "Welcome, Dr. Taylor." I have never seen ice broken so expertly. The other incident illustrates that I grew old in my job, but I loved it. I started teaching at St. Ambrose College in 1948. After a few years of teaching, I learned that behind my back, many of the students were calling me Aunt Mary. Then one day in class, a few years later, I reprimanded a student who grinned and said with resignation in his voice, "Yes, Mother." and more years passed. I was somewhat of a thorn in the flesh of administration because I was disturbed about the fact that they were cutting down 100-year-old oak trees to make room for parking lots and such. There was one particularly magnificent oak back of the biology building. I heard a rumor that they were going to cut it down to make room for a road through the campus. Since there was plenty of room for the road without cutting down the tree, I marched into the president's office and said a few words. At any rate, the oak was allowed to stand. A few years later, there was a knock on my office door. Two students that I didn't know stood there. One said, "Do you know if Mr. K has gone home?" Mr. K had the office next door to mine. I said, "I don't know, but if he is still on campus, his white Pontiac will be at the back door next to the big oak tree." Whereupon one student said to the other, "What oak tree?" The answer was, "For goodness sakes, don't you know Grandmother Vingy's oak tree?" And that seemed to be a good time to think about retiring. I hope you will forgive my having been so verbose, but with 7 years of crowded University of Wisconsin memories, plus the ramifications thereof, I found it impossible to condense that wonderful experience into a short story. I have enjoyed this journey down memory lane.
Oh,
by the way, P.S. After more than 50 years, I still use my old gooseneck student lamp with the UW seal and the little owl which is cast in the base. Signing off, Mary M. Taylor Vingy.